Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And it is another week where we get to take in one of Tim Brown of FootballArchaeology.com stories, his recent tidbits. Tim, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey there. Look forward to chatting, though. I think this episode is going to be full of a bunch of bull.
Well, many people do say that when you and I talk, but especially when we're talking on the same podcast episode. But yeah. I don't think you're going to give us any bull in the terms that maybe people are thinking about it, because you're segueing into a recent tidbit story you wrote that you had titled Bull Halsey, Palmer E. Pierce, and the 1905 Army-Navy Game. It's always good to talk about football history and Army-Navy Game. That's some excitement.
Yeah, so I'll have to go back to my youthful days. I had a history professor one time who I think, you know, he always had one of the cool techniques that he used in talking, or, you know, giving lectures, was he'd sprinkle in somebody who later became famous, who was at certain events or was involved in certain activities when they were just a schlub, right? So, you know, it might be a recent college graduate or something who ends up at the Democratic National Convention in, you know, 1920 or whatever it was. And, you know, but you kind of realize, okay, this is what, this had some influence on that person's policies, you know, later on down the road. So this is kind of one of those where it's a story about, you know, kind of a neat or an interesting event in football history, and specifically Army-Navy history. And it involves two people who later became very, you know, prominent individuals. So basically, you know, the start of the Army-Navy rivalry, Navy was playing football for, you know, a handful of years before Army did. And so they first met in 1890, and they played at West Point. For the first 4 years, they went back and forth, West Point, Annapolis, West Point, Annapolis. But, you know, it became a popular enough event and enough people wanted to see the Army-Navy game that they switched the location to Philadelphia and Penn's Franklin Field, which at the time was one of the biggest stadiums in the country. You know, and they played baseball there too, but it was, you know, designed as a track and football, you know, facility. But, you know, and over time, it kind of grew and grew. Right. So everybody who was anybody wanted to be at the game. And so, you know, literally Congress people would threaten not to fund certain activities for the academies if they didn't get tickets that they wanted. And then, you know, their alums wanted tickets, and, you know, generals and admirals, et cetera. And so part of one of the problems that developed by, after the 1904 game, was that since Penn hosted the game, they got a third of the tickets. So Penn, Army, and Navy each got a third of the tickets, and then they could distribute them how they wanted to. And so, you know, Penn gave some to their students, to their donors, and, you know, whatever, you know, influential people in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. And so Army and Navy didn't have as many tickets to give out as they wanted. And so they basically told Penn, hey, either you need to give us more of the tickets in order for us to continue coming here. And Penn was like, sorry, you know. And the other thing, even Penn didn't make any money on this thing, because they whatever they made off of ticket sales, they donated to an orphans fund for military, you know, children of, you know, service people that had been, you know, killed in on duty. So anyways, so the there were two people involved in negotiating this deal. One was Bull Halsey, who was effectively the Navy athletic director. He had a different title, but and then a guy named Palmer E. Pierce, who was Army's AD, at least for football. And so so it ends up with like letters being published in the Philadelphia Inquirer of the back and forth between Penn and these two guys. And eventually they kind of break off negotiations and say, okay, sorry, we're going to go elsewhere. So they move the 1905 game to Princeton, which is a perfectly fine place to watch a college football game. Again, at the time they had a decent sized stadium. But the problem with, you know, when they held the game at Penn in 1905, the problem was that I think Penn's facilities and everything worked well, assuming a lot of the attendees were going to be from the immediate area, you know, at, in Princeton, which is a fairly small town then, you know, students and, you know, somewhat reasonably located alums. But with Army Navy, it was like everybody was coming from somewhere else. So they had to have all these special trains come in. Princeton Stadium couldn't, or station couldn't really handle that level of traffic. So anyways, they were just, they didn't have enough restaurants, hotel rooms, all that kind of stuff. So just kind of the infrastructure at Princeton just didn't work. So there were a lot of people who were mad about the game being there. So Halsey and Pierce kind of have to, kind of had their tail between their legs, and they eventually they negotiate a new deal with Penn for the following year, in which Penn would add temporary seats behind one of the end zones. Well, it wasn't end zones yet, but anyways, behind the goal line, and then they basically said, okay, you two get all the seats there. You're right. So basically, Army and Navy got more tickets than they had originally been asking for, which was great for them. And Penn got to keep all the same seats that they had had in the past. Mm-hmm. So the whole deal, you know, and then they basically stayed at Franklin Field for a number of years. Sometimes they play in New York, and they eventually moved to like Municipal Stadium and Veterans Stadium, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, Franklin Field has been one of their primary, Philadelphia, I should say, has been one of their primary locations. So one of the things that I think just is interesting about it is just, you know, when we think about building a stadium today, you basically build a stadium to fill the thing every weekend, right? Mm-hmm. At least every week there's a game. But back then, that's not the way it worked. It was, you know, like Harvard Stadium, you know, anybody's interest, go on Wikipedia and look at the attendance at games in 1903, 1904, you know, through the 20s. And a lot of times the lesser games, some of them, they have 5,000 people in that stadium that sat 33,000, right? And then when they added the, you know, the end zone seats, it's, you know, handle whatever, 45 or something. So a lot of times these stadiums were built for the maximum capacity needed as opposed to the consistent capacity, right? Because they wanted their alums, influential alums and donors, to be able to get a seat to the big game. And they only wanted it for one game a year, really. So, you know, Yale, you know, the Yale Bowl and Harvard are kind of classic examples of that. So anyways, you know, that was just kind of, it was a different mindset for how stadiums were built and not built. And yet Army and Navy never built sizable stadiums. You know, they stayed with stadiums that work for their normal crowds. And when they play their one big game a year, they go somewhere else, you know, Veterans State, you know, whatever, wherever the, I don't even know the name of the stadium in Philadelphia anymore, but
I think it's Lincoln Financial Field.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it was just kind of a different time and a different logic in terms of the stadiums themselves. But then the other thing about the story is just, you know, these two guys. So, you know, Bull Halsey ends up being like the number two guy in the U.S. Navy in the Pacific during World War II. You know, he ends up being a fleet admiral, you know, I think. So, I mean, he was a big deal, but he was like the AD back then. He had only graduated, you know, like 2 years before, and he'd played football, you know, for Navy. And then Palmer Pierce, who had never played football, ends up, you know, in so they hold the game in at Princeton in 1905, and then right during all that period is when all the, you know, the football crisis is going on. And as West Point's representative, he becomes West Point's representative to the, you know, Intercollegiate Association of United, you know, whatever it was, kind of the predecessor to the NCAA. And Army held a certain position, you know, their view of, so like, NYU is the one who started this effort to create a new set of rulemaking body. And, but they were kind of radical. They were considered, you know, thinking about dropping football, you know, they, and Army was like, no, we're going to keep playing. So we got to find a way to work with the existing rulemakers. And Army's view predominated in the early meetings. So then they hooked up with camp and all those guys with the university club. And the two groups merged and eventually created the new rules, right? And then the that organization became the NCAA in 1910. And, you know, through the whole time from the point it was founded until 1913, this Palmer E. Pierce was the president of that organization. So he was the first head of the NCAA and its predecessor. And you know, I mean, it wasn't like today's president of the NCAA. It was, you know, like a part-time sort of role, volunteer role. But nevertheless, you know, he was a key figure in the early days of the NCAA. And
it was probably more football-centric back then, too.
Yeah, it was very much so. I think, you know, I don't know that his role was football-centric just because, you know, he wasn't a football expert. He was pretty much into... let the people who know football do the rulemaking. He was more like the organizer, the, you know, get everybody working together kind of guy, and make sure, you know, he was like the strategy guy. We're going ahead in this direction. Now I'm going to let all the other people do their thing and create the rules. But, you know, still a fundamental figure in, you know, in the future direction of American football.
Yeah, I mean, it's something probably that all of us take for granted. These people that are behind the scenes and organizing these big games and scheduling, and the athletic directors and their staffs and everything. But we wouldn't have any of these games going on or be marketed like they are today, or even, you know, 100 some years ago, if it wasn't for these individuals. And I'm glad that you shed some light on who they are and give them some credit and some accolades that they well deserve.
Yeah, well, even like, you know, I mean, I've been aware of Bull Halsey for, you know, since I was probably 12 or something like that, right? But Palmer Pierce is a relatively, you know, I didn't know about him until fairly recently, you know, and then, but, you know, you dig into this stuff and eventually it's like, well, you know, you just come across things in doing research and it's like, wow, this guy, he's a much bigger deal than, you know, I had any idea about.
Yeah, and I think that's a familiar theme that you have with your tidbits. That's the one great thing what football archaeology does, is it sheds some light on some folks that maybe were forgotten over time. And you do this quite a bit in your tidbits. Maybe you could share with us and the listeners, you know, how can we partake and learn some of these great things that you do in your tidbits?
Yeah, just go to footballarchaeology.com. It's a Substack site. You can subscribe. In which case you'll get an email every time I publish a new story, which is typically, you know, a couple times a week. And then, you know, one day a week, the podcast, you know, gets published as well on your site. And then I promote it on mine. So yeah, that's the way to do it. And I would just say, You know, another thing, you know, I know that a lot of people don't go back and read the archives, but, you know, including podcasts, you know, we've got something, you know, almost 1500 stories out there. So if you're looking for something on football history, and especially maybe pre-World War II, you know, I may well have covered something on the topic before. So, you know, go search, use the search function, and you'll probably find some, you know, some fun stuff.
Yeah, very powerful little magnifying glass there. You have sort of partway down your page. It's great to do that. I use it quite often doing my research. So, Tim, we really appreciate you sharing this with us today, just like you do each week. And we'd love to talk to you again next week.
See you in 7 days.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hi, everyone. There's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.